sunny and mild. Today's high 53, inland 48 near Lake Michigan. Tonight, cloudy and 35. Tomorrow, Thursday, 40% chance of rain. Tomorrow's high 47. Right now, sunny, 34 degrees, Racine, 35, Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, next.
Support for the morning show comes from Jack Andrea, featuring Easter candy, new apparel, and garden accessories in its recently remodeled gift shop. Open Monday through Friday from 9 until 6 and Saturday from 9 until 5. More information at jackandrea.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I urge you to take a look, if you possibly can, at a fascinating new book called Servants, A Downstairs History of Britain from the 19th Century to Modern Times by Lucy Lethbridge, in which we are taken into the heart of the experience of servants, butlers, maids, and all other variants, and the way in which they functioned within various kinds of British homes, and not only within the borders of Britain, but Lucy Lethbridge's fascinating book even takes us into places like the nation of India and other points of the British Empire to help us understand where some of these rich and sometimes even bewildering traditions sprung. And, of course, what led ultimately to the demise of this fascinating world. Lucy Lethbridge has written for the London Observer, the Sunday Telegraph, the Times Literary Supplement, among other British publications. Again, her book is Servants, A Downstairs History of Britain from the 19th Century to Modern Times. Lucy Lethbridge, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning.
It's an absolutely fascinating book. I've enjoyed it so much. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about how challenging it is for a historian like yourself to unlock some of the secrets of the real-life experiences of servants. I mean, given the station of life in which they lived and the obscurity in which most of them, in a sense, worked. How difficult did it make it, the challenge then, for you to bring their experiences to life for us?
Well, of course, history is generally written by upstairs rather than downstairs, because downstairs is too busy working to sit down and write letters and diaries and autobiographies. So it was difficult, I wanted to get the real voices and personalities that had facilitated this, an American journalist called a golden dream, which is the sort of flourishing of the great country house in the 19th and early 20th century. So, well, the first thing I did was I advertised in various magazines and for people who'd been in service before the Second World War. I knew I had to do that quite quickly because, of course, they would be very old. And I got a huge response, and not only from people who had been in service, but for people who had letters, diaries, trunks full of photographs from relations who'd been in service. And so gradually this material started to open up. And there was more than I had thought there would be, and of a huge and wide variety. And it was wonderful, actually, to be able to give voices for the first time to these people.
Right. You know, I think another thing important about your book is that it reminds us that although we might immediately think of the Downton Abbey scenario of a huge country estate and a huge number of servants, that that's what this experience encompasses, Your book also reminds us that all kinds of people had servants, including people who could barely afford to have servants. And so this sometimes occurred on a very modest scale, and also on a grand scale as well. So it's important for us not to generalize too much when we talk about this experience.
Oh, most definitely. And in fact, I think the Downton Abbey, as it were, as a sort of shorthand, is the most public face of that kind of huge servanted household. But it represents about 2% of the experience of most servants. If you were relatively lucky if you got into a country house like Downton Abbey because you were comfortable, well fed, and you had a career ladder. And it's very important to look at, and I think, in fact, Downton Abbey does this quite well, that those large country houses did offer a career progression. You could go in at the bottom and work your way up to the top and to a senior managerial role, like a butler or a housekeeper. But in the vast majority, really the vast majority of servants, were single-handed girls working in slightly cash-strapped lower-middle-class houses where they had to do all the work. And it was very hard labour, and with very little time off, not very good food, and it's not to say you weren't always well treated. Were always badly treated. Sometimes you were well treated, but nonetheless, it was a job that didn't offer much progression upward.
One of the most interesting observations you make is about how, when it came to modern innovations to help make, for instance, housekeeping, house cleaning, the preparation of food easier and more convenient, that in many cases it was Britain and the upper classes of Britain who were most resistant to those technological breakthroughs, which would have made life so much easier for the servants. Give our listeners one or two examples of what I'm talking about.
Well, yes, I think it is interesting how resistant the upper classes became to new technology. They weren't at the very beginning, but I think from the mid-19th century onwards, there was a lot of social unrest about the Industrial Revolution. There was a lot of unease about a new urbanized laboring class. There were fears about revolution. There were fears about sort of social unrest. And having servants became a way of maintaining the status quo, maintaining this sort of paternalistic dependency. And so new technologies got in the way of that, you know, because if you have a washing machine, you might, you know, it sort of, as it were, it gets in the way of the relationship between master and servant, which is very important to upholding that sort of unshifting status quo. And there were some fascinating little statistics I came up with that I had absolutely no idea about. I mean, I had no idea, for example, that in 1960, only 80% of houses in this country had electricity. I mean, that seemed to me absolutely astonishing in 1960.
So for instance, then you have all kinds of servants where their only job is to maintain the gas lamps throughout a huge country home. I mean, you need to have people doing that if you are not willing to, for instance, shift to the convenience of electricity where you can just flip a light switch on and off. It's almost as though this society went out of its way to keep life in an antiquated sort of state in which you needed all these servants.
And in fact, technology then becomes associated with something rather suburban and middle class, you know, and there are lots of jokes about people having toasters. Toasters were always considered very sort of middle class. And it was just the possession of a toaster let everyone know that you weren't from the top drawer. So there are lots of very sort of complicated things around technologies. But of course, the other thing that one has to remember is that we went through, like as you did in the States, we went through an enormous economic depression between the wars, and people were reluctant to dismiss their servants because they knew they were throwing them out onto a situation that was mass unemployment. So people quite often kept these vast staffs out of kindness, you know. So maintained these absurd rituals and old-fashioned things, just, you know, simply to protect their own staff against unemployment.
You certainly explore some interesting things in the fourth chapter called Centralizing the Egg Yolks, in which you say this at one point: all sorts of desires become elevated to necessities when there is someone to do the hard labor of realizing them for you. And I suppose when that's true, when you have servants at your beck and call ready to act upon your every whim, indeed a culture of what we might now regard as absurdity begins to spring up.
Well, I think that was one of the most fascinating things I found, actually. When I started my research, I hadn't even thought about that aspect of things. But it did seem to me that, and I suppose we see, this is the sort of excess we see in pop stars, don't we, when we learn about them, you know, wanting their hotel suites repainted and so on, that if there is someone to do work for you, then what would, then a sort of kind of private predilection suddenly becomes, you know, something that you can't possibly live without. It's a sort of, it becomes a compulsion. So
and
you do get the story. Yes, go on.
That's fine. No, and on the other hand, one thing I really appreciate about your book is that although you spend a fair amount of time, and I'm glad you do, talking about such things, on the other hand, you are also very careful to acknowledge that in many cases we're talking about something that's quite admirable and even beautiful that will sometimes spring up between servants and masters or those that they serve, although sometimes it can be very hard to know exactly where that is. At one point, you said that the nature of the servant-master bond becomes harder to quantify the more intimate it becomes. That sometimes we're talking about mutual affection, you tell us even love between servant and those they serve. What is it that is so difficult to quantify or really make clear about the nature of these relationships?
Well, I think this is one of the great difficulties, and I think this is why the area of domestic service is largely left out of histories of labor, which tend to concentrate on factory workers and so on, because the relationships in the home, you share your home with someone over a number of years, that relationship is never, ever going to be exactly employer and employee, is it? It can't be. A sort of intimacy creeps in, which is will be slightly different in every home. And that's what I think made regulation, when legislation and regulation for domestic service has always been very difficult to impose, precisely because of that. It looks like a kind of state intervention into a familial relationship. But there were some very touching stories of I tended to find employers call them relationships of love. Employees don't tend to. Servants don't use the word love when they talk about their employers. But you know, there was one coachman, an old coachman whose employer said to him, it was about 1910, as she was on her deathbed, she sent for him, and she said, take me in your arms, you know, her oldest friend, her oldest companion, and I don't know, it's very hard to draw conclusions about these things other than to say, you know, the variations of human experience are all there.
Right, and I think one of the most oddest things about all this is how, on the one hand, in many cases, especially with these large country estates, there would be a very careful sort of geographic separation between the so-called upstairs and downstairs. And yet, at the same time, there's this incredible intimacy and proximity. Servants were always there, always at beck and call, in the midst of the family's life, and yet not entirely there. I mean, that's one of the hardest things, I think, for us as outsiders looking in to understand.
Yes, it's interesting, isn't it? And I think what's so fascinating is that the upstairs-downstairs idea of, as it were, the whole architecture of the house reflecting these two households, you know, you get backstairs, servants' entrances, basements, you know, back corridors, you know, green baize doors, all those separations, is essentially a completely Victorian invention. If you had been to an 18th-century household, you would have found the servants sleeping in the same beds as their masters. There was a far more a sort of sprawling kind of mass of kind of dependence and underdependence, and no one wearing uniform, no one, the separation was far less obvious. But it's the Victorians, and I think, again, it's part of this social unrest, this feeling of social unrest that I mentioned before, who initiate this sort of this absolute separation within the home, which I think gives rise to a resentment that never really quite goes away. This feeling of being having a sort of identity that is different, of not being permitted to have an identity that can ever change.
It's as though they drew comfort and encouragement and a sense of stability from that strict sense of hierarchy, and this just underscored it. It's one of many fascinating observations you make in your wonderful book, again called Servants, A Downstairs History of Britain from the 19th Century to Modern Times. Lucy Lethbridge, thank you so much for writing such a wonderful book.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two is coming up in just a moment. Of all of the creatures on earth, there's maybe no creature more beautiful than a horse. And horses also, for as, in a sense, commonplace as they are also creatures of, in a sense, some mystery to most of us. And one person who understands horses in a very, very profound way is Dr. Alan J. Hamilton. And Dr. Hamilton, in addition to his work as a very successful neurosurgeon, I believe, has also for a quarter of a century worked closely with and trained horses. And he has come to a very, very deep understanding of what is important to horses, of the way that they learn, the way that they interact with one another, the way they see the world. And he's come to understand a number of different lessons that we can learn from horses. And these are lessons that can be applied to many different facets of our daily lives. And I'm really excited to be able to speak with Dr. Hamilton about his very, very intriguing book. He's also the author of a previous book called Zen Mind, Zen Horse. And by the way, he was a medical script consultant for the hit television series Grey's Anatomy. So Dr. Hamilton is a busy, busy man, but I'm glad his busy schedule allowed him to write this really interesting book and to join me on The Morning Show to talk about it. The book is published by Story Publishing. Again, it's called Lead With Your Heart, Lessons from a Life with Horses. Dr. Alan J. Hamilton, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Well, thanks for having me, Greg.
Glad to be talking with you. It's a beautiful book, and it's beautiful in terms of its content and also just in its appearance as well. I have to say this book visually is sort of a work of art. Can you just say a word about that?
Well, I was very pleased. Story put a lot of resources and artwork in it to sort of make it into more like a gift book, if you will. But they did a beautiful, beautiful job, and the artwork is just by a wonderful artist named Robert Farkas, and he's just these spectacular drawings, and so it makes for a beautiful gift, even if you're not a horse person. As you said, it's about 112 lessons, and that you can apply to your life in general.
And it's a book that's just over 200 pages long, so it's not a massive book, and these are short little chapters. They are easily read, easily digested, but they give us so much to think about. And so I really commend you on a job well done.
Oh,
so tell us when you first began working with horses. When and why did that happen?
Well, it's a long story, but I'll tell you the brief version. I came from a home where there was domestic violence, and my father was physically abusive, and my grandfather and my mom left, and my grandfather raised me, and he was a cavalry officer and a very fine equestrian. And so I really, probably genetically, but certainly environmentally, I really got the bug. And I started teaching, riding at summer camp when I was a counselor, and it just kept going deeper and deeper. And I've been training horses here in the States and abroad for the last quarter century. And I have to say, I just sort of keep going back to the well for me. I just find that horses are wonderful teachers about life lessons, and I'm kind of dumb in some ways, and I think the horses are just sitting there very patiently going, don't worry, he'll come around, don't worry, he'll come around, he'll see the light. So I kind of think of them as these sages, out in the pastures that are sort of, waiting, going, oh, we'll see, grasshopper, if you're ready, So it's been a lifelong project, and ever since I can remember, I've been nuts about horses. So it's it's in my blood.
Right. So explain, for instance, at this moment in time, how many horses do you have, and what kind of place do they occupy in your daily life?
So we have some of my own horses, and I've raised Lipizzans, which are these beautiful dressage horses, and then a number of people bring horses to us for training, for 30, 60, or 90 days. And we have a beautiful setting here in the desert with very lush pastures. Actually, it's kind of surprising and shocking when you think you're in the desert, but this is in a very low-lying aquifer, so there are beautiful trees and everything else. And, it's sort of horse heaven. And I have to say, I have a lot of help training horses, and I always say, I get up in the middle of the night and start working the horses at like 5 a.m. And then I go to work and I do my, my daily work as a brain surgeon. And then I kind of crawl home in the evening, have dinner, maybe go out under the lights and work the horses again. And, occasionally a weekend and that sort of thing. But I kind of jam it all in so that the horses are getting worked every day, 5-6 days a week kind of thing. But it's very fulfilling, I have to say. And even my wife sometimes will say, okay, why don't you just finish up and go out with the horses, because it's pretty clear you need to go there and spend some time with them. So I know I'm in trouble when she sends me out to work the horses. But it is very soothing on the soul. And as I said, they have passed on wonderful life lessons. Sometimes I wish I had learned them earlier in life, but I'm always grateful whenever, I finally get the lesson from the horse.
This book feels like something that did not spring into being overnight. I'm curious at what point in time you began actually working on this book versus how long have these lessons been sort of learned over the course of time?
Well, that's a very interesting question, Greg, because it's funny you should say that. The way this started out was with, those little golf pencils that people take when they play golf, those tiny little pencils.
Right.
This started off with like some 3x5 cards in the back pocket of my jeans and a golf pencil. And I would sort of go off and I just would make some notes as I was riding. And I would put the back in my pocket and just kind of refer to them and keep them in the barn and, kind of stick them back in and add some more. And it would go on like that. And I would say probably 5 or 6 years like that. And I began to see that as I would go back to some of the earlier cards, I would begin to see that there was kind of a progression through it. And originally my idea was, I'll make something that somebody could just stick in their back pocket. But Story Publishing began to put the book together, they really had some very good ideas about how to make it thematically and make it more applicable to every person's life rather than just horsey people, as we say. And that's sort of how it evolved. I had written Zen Mind, Zen Horse, and I thought, well, I'm done. But then I saw, no, wait a minute. There's more of a progression, and it's getting deeper and deeper. And it was really on these cards for a very long time before we started thinking about how do we transfer it to a book.
Hmm. So one of the most interesting things about the book is the way it's laid out in these various sections. And I really, really appreciate that it's not just a big long laundry list of lessons, but lessons that sort of coalesce around different themes. And one of them being teaching, and another being leadership, and another being around just finding more mindfulness in life. Now, is that more the hand of an editor, kind of sorting out these lessons into these themes, or is that something that began to occur to you as well?
No, that began to occur to me as I started, going through and seeing a progression, and I started clumping them. And then I began to realize that I could take two or three of these index cards and put them together, and they made, and I would give them a title and then start taking what I had on the 3x5 cards. So each of these titles was sort of already one lesson, and it might have been two or three or five cards that I then condensed down into one page or half a page essay. But that's really how it came about. And then we ended up with 112 lessons.
Hmm. Let's start with the beginning of the book, in which the section is called Teaching and Learning. And this is actually probably a really good place to begin because, in a sense, this springs so directly out of the work that you have done as a trainer of horses about what real teaching is, what real learning is, and about the ways in which we can kind of draw from these interactions that you've had with horses over the years. One of the most important things that you tell us is that you treat each of these horses as an individual. And you caution teachers to think in a similar way, that the idea of one size fits all is going to be almost certainly detrimental to good teaching taking place.
I think we all do teaching. We're not aware of it, but as parents we do teaching. Sometimes as spouses we teach each other. And I think for me, I teach at a major university and have taught all my life. But the thing there about when you approach a new horse for training is you have to figure out where is that individual horse. There's not going to be any recipe. You're going to have to sort out exactly what that horse is used to, exactly what that horse feels comfortable with. And some horses are more playful. Other horses are more looking for affection. Other horses are I was looking at you were the son of a Lutheran minister, and so it's sort of kind of a Lutheran work ethic. a lot of quarter horses have that sort of work ethic. So you sort of look for each horse, and you try and get a feel for their personality, and they're doing the same for you. They're much faster at reading us than we are reading them. A horse will read a human being in 20, 30 seconds. But for me, with the horse, I'm moving them around. I'm trying to see how they want to come to me, how they want to move away from me, what seems to motivate them. Are they more motivated by, kind of the reward of doing something and then getting that affection? Or are they more rewarded by sort of coming into my circle and being able to stand next to me and me able to reinforce with them that, hey, when you stand next to me, you're going to have a quiet, tranquil, peaceful, soft partner. So I think the same thing happens with students, and I think, for example, one of the things I've never quite understood is that you can go into the first grade and you can ask first grade children, how many of you in this class are artists? And 90% of the hands will go up. You take that same class and go into the sixth grade and ask the same question, and less than 10% of the hands go up. So we've eliminated the artists virtually. And the same thing is true of horses. You don't want to eliminate the artist. You want that individual personality and creativity and verve and enthusiasm. You want it to be there. And you kill it when you just try to apply a method blindly. And I think, you know, this that with our children, what we want to do is have them have the feel for maximal creativity, the sense of being maximally immersed in what they're doing and getting tremendous self-gratification out of it. So, you know, it's sort of the same thing. If we approach our kids as individuals, we will keep the artist alive. And the equivalent of that in the horse is that you keep the horse's personality completely alive and intact, and you don't dull it with drills and schedules and kind of a recipe style of training, but really individualized for what that horse's strengths and weaknesses are.
Right. I appreciated in this section of the book, I mean, so many things, because I happen to be a teacher as well, and I'm married to a teacher.
I
especially appreciated the section where you talk about cultivating a beginner's mind. I appreciated this because I find teaching at the collegiate level that this is one of the hardest things, that by the time a young man or a young woman is 18, 19, 20 years old, they don't want to be a beginner at anything. So if they are learning to sing their first song in French or having to take the very first piano lessons they've ever taken in their entire life, by and large, that is an awkward and difficult position for them to find themselves in as a beginner at such an advanced age, in a sense. And I loved how this chapter kind of turns that on its head, and you make the state of being a beginner a wonderful thing, a moment full of promise.
Yeah, I think, you know, the beginner's mind has to be both in the teacher and the student. I think that's what you sort of learn from horses, which is don't approach the horse or the student, you know, that where you're confident in what you know and you're the expert, but instead, you know, you want to keep an open mind. And that means that you are looking at the possibilities. You're not, so for example, with a horse, you're not limited to thinking about what you think should happen with the horse in terms of the training. You want to really come at it with, I don't know all the possibilities of how this horse learns or what this horse is capable of, but I'm going to be completely open to anything that's going to be happening. And I don't set limits by my own expectations. Oh, you know, this horse is going to be a good hunter jumper, or this is going to be a good Western pleasure. And the same thing happens with students, I think. We go in, you know, and we think, well, we're the teacher, we're the professor, whatever, and we have this a schedule or you know, curriculum that we think is has to be taught. And part of that problem is you're not coming in with a beginner's mind. You're not open to the possibility that the students may take you to some place you didn't expect, that surprised you, and that actually you know, interested you. And I think the more I teach, the longer I teach, the more I realize that the students have, in some ways, a lot more to teach me than I have to teach them, but I have to keep the beginner's mind there. So, for example, I might not be as digitally gifted in social media as my students are, but I want to have a beginner's mind that they are going to open my eyes to all of the different possibilities. So I think it's that, you know, horses teach you from the get-go that the more of an agenda that you have, the more you constrain the outcome.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Dr. Alan J. Hamilton about his book, Lead With Your Heart, Lessons from a Life with Horses. There are so many other good points that you make in this particular section of the book, including some very, very thoughtful words about the importance of patience. I wonder if you could say a word about the importance of correction or reprimanding. Because I think you speak really, really interestingly on this topic. Just talk about your guiding principles when it comes to correcting a horse or reprimanding it, and how applicable you think those principles are to the correcting or reprimanding that we need to do in our own lives and interacting with other humans.
Well, I think that we, you know, first the horses have taught me a great deal, and I have to say, I wish they had taught it to me a little sooner because I think I would have been a better parent for it. I think the horse is much more motivated by the positive part of correction than by the harsher punishment, if you will. And we have a natural tendency to think that negative reinforcement works, you know. But in fact, you know, one thing psychology, and I'm married to a clinical psychologist, so one of the things is that psychology has said over and over and over again is negative reinforcement does not work that well. So one of the things that I look for with the horse is I want to correct him, but I don't want to punish him. And so what I'm looking for is my job is to make it as easy for him to succeed as possible. And sometimes people say, well, that's cheating, you know, because I'll say, well, let's work on the horse standing still when he's really tired. And they go, well, of course he's going to stand still when he's tired. And I go, well, that's my point. It's going to make it very easy for me to teach him the skill. So, you know, I think I always say, think about teaching like skiing. When it's good skiing and it makes it easy for the student, it's like skiing downhill. And when the horse is trying not to do, is sort of going in the wrong direction, I make it like skiing uphill. So I'm always motivating the horse to look for the easiest way to learn the task and make it easy for him to succeed. And I think that's another thing that I say in the book. We don't reward frequently enough. We don't. I have a saying in my barn, which is, you know, ask for a lot, settle for less, and reward frequently. We have to spend more time in our lives at work, in our lives with our family, our lives with our friends, making people understand that we are rewarding them, we're appreciating what they're doing. And, you know, I think my mantra when I'm training horses is pause, pet, breathe. And that's after everything that I do with the horse, every single movement, I'll pause, pet, and breathe. So I send that horse a signal with my body that I'm taking a breath and I'm relaxing, but I'm also petting him because I'm saying, hey, thank you for doing that for me.
Hmm.
And I think we don't reward frequently enough.
Right. I like the very simple two-word title of that chapter, Reward Abundantly.
Yeah.
A couple other lessons I want to ask you about. One of them is really intriguing. I should say some of these lessons, in a sense, are on the surface relatively obvious, although I think in almost every single case, you go beyond the obvious and share some insights that take us beyond the obvious and the inevitable. And then there are some cases in which you, for instance, draw distinctions between terms that I've never heard drawn before. For instance, in the section of the book about leading and following, when you draw a distinction between idleness and stillness, explain why this distinction is so important.
Well, I think that you know, you have to think about, people tend to think that, you know, being out there in the round pen where it's sort of a physical equivalent, I think that's what makes it to me so easy with horses, is it's not just not moving. A lot of people think it's just not moving your feet and not being, but it's not. It is good trainers use their energy very eloquently, and they use it very sparingly. And so what they want to do is not overwhelm the horse with dominance or power or, you know, might is right, but instead get as quiet as they can and use the least amount of energy as possible, and calling the least amount of attention to yourself and keeping the attention focused on the horse. And I have another section where I go, self praise stinks. and that is, you know, in life, don't call attention to yourself. Call attention to others. Call attention to the people who are the focus of what you're doing. And real power is born out of stillness. There's great power in quietness. And I'll give you an example from my professional life. which seems very far afield from the round pen and training horses. When I go to a code, okay, when we're resuscitating a patient, I want to walk in with my body as quiet and peaceful as possible, and I want my voice to be soft. And the reason is I want my team to understand I'm not panicking, okay? I'm nice and quiet, and I lower my voice so they have to listen, because as I do that, I quiet the whole room down, and I get everybody thinking about this patient and getting our job done and not letting the adrenaline run away with us. And so, you know, again, it's that real power, real leadership comes out of quiet stillness, not out of exuberant displays of energy.
A couple other interesting ideas include this phrase, the curve of compromise. That is so beautiful, even before we read the chapter and kind of learn more about what's behind those intriguing words. And it seems to me that in this day and age in which we live, this is one lesson that a whole lot of us need to learn. Talk about the curve of compromise.
We're predators. The horse is the prototypic prey animal, but we're predators. We go directly at what we want, and we tend to apply our energy to that object. So in equivalent of a horse, that means when we want the horse to leave and lead, you know, follow us, we pull on that lead rope, okay? But the real problem is, yes, you have a 1,200-pound horse on the end of your lead rope, but the other way of looking at it is the 1,200-pound horse has you on the end of the lead rope. And if you start creating resistance, which is what we do as predators, then the horse starts to create resistance, and you have to say to yourself, what chance do I really have against a 1,200-pound horse? The answer is none. If that horse makes up their mind, they're not going to do what you want. So instead of escalating those lines of resistance with the lead rope, what I encourage people to do when I'm training them with their horses is have the horse turn on a curve and flow with you, okay, because it makes it much easier for the horse to move out. So I said, look in your life. Where are you at work or at home creating lines of resistance which only encourage escalation? And instead, look for flow, look for a curve of compromise where you can walk off in a partnership. And it's much gentler, it's much more elegant, and the real thing that happens is the horse is moving out of his own volition. There's no application of force. And I think, you know, you can apply this in your own life, but you could just as easily say, let's apply this in politics, where we are constantly creating lines of resistance as opposed to looking where the areas are that we can create curves of compromise.
I wonder if you could say a word about the words that open this section of the book where you talk about the best kind of leader. This is also something that in the times in which we live and this particular season in which we find ourselves, that this is important for us to consider. What do you see? What have you learned from your horses in terms of the most important characteristics of great leadership?
The thing to remember with the horses is they're a herd. They see themselves not just as individuals, but much more as a we than a me. And what they're looking for is usually it's the alpha mare who's running the herd, and they're looking for an alpha mare that has what I call the four C's of leadership, which is really command, control, communication, and compassion. They need a leader who's going to keep the herd safe and understands how to move that herd to safety very quickly if there's a predator or a threat. So they need to be able to command the herd quickly, control where the horses stand, but that leader also puts themselves at risk. That leader is the one that confronts the threat and tells the herd whether it's safe for them to move on. So they have to be able to communicate that, and then they have to have compassion in the sense that they have to put the good of the herd, the good of the we, before anything else. It doesn't do them any good to say, well, there's just enough feed for me and the rest of the herd can stay behind. That's not how they think. They'll be saying, is there enough for all of us? Is there enough to support? Is there enough browse? Is there enough water? And so the idea of the leader is you earn the leadership position from the herd every day by demonstrating that you put their interests before your own, that you encounter the threats, that you put yourself at risk, and you are displaying the four C's of leadership.
I want to finish by saying that one of the things I especially appreciated about your book is the beautifully written acknowledgments. And beyond thanking your grandfather, whom you've already talked about in this interview, and thanking, of course, the horses, including those with whom you've felt really close, I think you do a really beautiful job of acknowledging the support that you've received both from your wife, Jane, and from your three children. I think, if I understand correctly, none of them, in your words, have been bitten by the horse bug. But they have not only not stood in the way, but they have really respected this facet of your life and the measure of devotion that you've shown to your horses. Just talk for a moment about how important this has been to you.
Well, I think there's a group, when comedians die, they go up to heaven, and there's like a cosmic dead comedians club, and they meet, and they sort of say, what would be really funny is we'll get this guy who's just totally in love with horses, and then what we'll do is we'll embed him in a family that he loves, but nobody in the family cares anything about horses, and let's see what happens, okay? And so you're here's my family living at this ranch, you know, filled with horses. I remember one morning I had a pony for my daughter outside her window when she was about 11 with a big bow on it. And I said, you know, happy birthday, sweetheart. And I pulled open the blinds and she saw this pony and she looked at it and she looked back and she said, Dad, where are my birthday presents? You know, so it was one of these things. And I think that it would have been very easy for my family to have poo-pooed everything, to have... They also gave up a lot for us to live on the ranch and to see me, you know, really putting a lot of my time and resources into horses. And I think they just understood that this was much more, a real spiritual pursuit for me. And I think they supported me in it and really were there for me.
I really encourage people to check out this book and to read it thoroughly as I have, because it gave me so much to think about and so much to think about in just about all of the different walks of my own life, professionally and personally as well. And I just can't give a higher compliment to a book than that. The book, again, is called Lead With Your Heart, Lessons from a Life with Horses, published by Story Publishing, featuring the beautiful illustrations of Robert Farkas and the sensitive writing of Dr. Alan J. Hamilton. Dr. Hamilton, I really have enjoyed our conversation and very much appreciate your book. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Greg, for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, you'll hear my conversation with Rachel Simmons, the author of a book called Enough As She Is, How to Help Girls Move Beyond Impossible Standards of Success to Live Happy and Fulfilling Lives. On Friday, I'll be speaking with a faculty colleague of mine in the music department at Carthage, Dr. Wael Farouk, who is an extraordinary concert pianist. And he has an amazing event coming up in early April in which he is going to be playing in the space of one evening all five piano concertos of the great Ludwig van Beethoven, a monumental undertaking. And we'll be speaking with him about that and about these incredible works by one of history's greatest geniuses. There'll be no morning show on Monday because of the Easter holiday, but on Tuesday we'll be previewing for you the next production of the Over Our Head Players in Racine. Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Jack and Drea, featuring Easter candy, new apparel, and garden accessories in its recently remodeled gift shop. Open Monday through Friday, 9 to 6, and Saturday.